This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. I don't know if you've heard yet, but today is the end of the world. So it is possible that mine is the very last voice you'll ever hear. According to certain people, the ancient Mayan civilization predicted thousands of years ago that the world would end on December 21st, 2012. This is the date that their long count calendar supposedly ends. Now, it turns out that view stems from a pretty bad understanding of the Mayan calendar, but you never know. An exhibit at UNC's Wilson Library is exploring the Mayans. It's called Ancient and Living Maya in the 19th and 20th Centuries, Archaeological Discovery, Literary Voice, and Political Struggle. And joining us now to talk about all of that is Claudia Funke. She is a curator of rare books at the Wilson Library, and Emilio de Valle Escalante, who is an associate professor of Spanish at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So, Emilio, the big question on everybody's mind, how much longer do we have today?
Just a few more minutes, I guess.
Okay.
It's just amazing to me to read this type of news about the end of the world. It is a misunderstanding of what my ancestors sort of had in mind. But it is not going to be the end of the world. It's just going to be the end of a long, long cycle that is going to be representing the end of 144,000 days on December 21st and just the beginning of a new Baktun, the 14th Baktun.
How is that cycle determined?
Apparently, this is based on the on evidence that archaeologists have found in terms of specific dates referenced in written documents. Apparently, there is a beginning, a point of departure of this long count Maya calendar. And it occurred in sometime in 3114 BC. That's sort of like the point zero, and that's sort of like the beginning of the long count Maya calendar. And so, with December 21st, we're going to be completing 1,870,000 days. Mm. With the closing of this Baktun.
It's a very sophisticated calendar, and it has lots and lots of purposes, not mm-hmm. just for figuring out when to put the crops in, when to take them out, right?
Right.
Give us an idea of what was the function of this calendar, or functions?
Well, the thing is, there is also a lot of discussion, because some archaeologists even suggest that by the time of the arrival of the Spanish, there are suggestions that this calendar was not even in use, but nonetheless, some of the things that has been suggested, some of the purposes of this calendar was just not only to mark time but also to record specific dates related to eclipses or important dates regarding people in power, wars.
And it's not cyclical in the same sense of there's sort of 365 days, and then every 4 years we've got to add one. There's a better way of counting time on this, or a more precise way. Am I right about that? That in some ways, this calendar is a more precise way of measuring time and keeping us in sync with planetary motions.
Yes, I think it's. I think you're right about that, and it's because you got to imagine the context of. Of the people that were working with this calendar. I mean, there wasn't TV or internet or anything like that, but rather what a lot of people did was to watch the stars and recording natural phenomena and things like that.
So. Make your observations and make them accurately enough over time, and you can begin to project what may happen in the future. So, Claudia, tell me about the exhibit at the Wilson Library. What is it, and what's the scope of this exhibit?
Okay, well, we decided... to put an emphasis on not just the story of decipherment of the Maya language, which everyone knows about from Nova and History and Discovery channels, but also to tell that story alongside the story of the Maya people. The reason that we did the exhibit it was part of programming. We did a big symposium in October. UNC Chapel Hill has actually now three Mayanists on faculty, Emilio being one of them. For 20 years, this is the 20th anniversary of the Yucatec Maya Summer Institute, 20 years that Yucatec Maya language has been taught at Chapel Hill. And we also, in 2006, received a large collection of research and rare materials from George and Melinda Stewart. George Stewart worked for over 40 years for National Geographic. And so we have a really splendid collection of Maya material, which we thought was very fitting to be shown at this time. And so what we've tried to do is to show that we've concentrated on the 19th and 20th centuries because that's the era of nation states. And once the Spanish rule collapsed in Mesoamerica, and those countries were opened to foreigners, to people from the United States and other European nations, a lot of different things happened, and there were a lot of power struggles. Even if we think about how the Western Hemisphere changed then in the course of the 19th century, you have parts of the United States being added that bring the United States closer to the Maya world. It was a period of enormous oppression for the Maya people. Truly, you know, the Maya chapter of the story of the history of the book and the rare book collection at Chapel Hill has a foundational mission from the Haynes Foundation for the study of the origin and development of the book. The Maya chapter in the history of the book is one of the most astonishing because basically you had the most enduring writing system of the pre-Columbian Americas from 500 BC until the 16th century when their hieroglyphic writing system was forcibly ended by the Spanish invaders. And then you had this period which began in the 19th century where people wanted to learn that writing system, these outsiders. It was very difficult for them to make a connection between the actual Maya who were living there and the spoken Maya languages. That was a big struggle intellectually for the people who were deciphering, for many of them to actually think that the language could be phonetic. And then, most astonishing to me, at the end of it all, really, and this is the area Emilio's a specialist in the 1960s and 1970s, Maya people at last get their voice back and begin to write in Spanish and Maya languages and to publish, and there's something of a Maya renaissance.
What happens to that language, though, in that period when it is forcibly repressed? What are we talking about when we say Mayan language? Mm-hmm. Are we talking about an ethnic group, a language that certainly changed a lot over that time and had certain and was very much influenced, I would guess, by European contact?
Yes, but the thing is, when we're talking about, we're not talking about one Maya language, but rather like in terms of the Mesoamerican region, southern Mexico, Belize, and Guatemala, and Honduras, we're talking about 31 surviving Maya languages. Some of them have even, a language like Maya Yucatec, has over 1 million speakers, or the language of my people, Maya Quiche, it's close to 1 million speakers as well. The Renaissance that Claudia is talking about is extremely important because it's giving visibility to a lot of authors coming from different ethnic and linguistic backgrounds. So literature has been employed as a way to empower these communities, but also to give visibility to the complexity of, you know, of this region in itself.
What impact does resurrecting and then teaching the language have on resurrecting the culture itself, understanding the culture, which again had, had changed probably pretty dramatically from its origins by the time the Spanish had gotten there, right?
Oh yeah, there are a lot of borrowing from, you know, Spanish, but also Spanish is borrowed from Maya languages. But literature in this sense has been extremely important and crucial for a lot of these authors because they are using it as a medium to voice not only what they think about, you know, specific governments, what they think about their neighbors or it is a way of narrating their histories, where we come from, and what we desire in this contemporary societies.
Claudia, we know that certainly Mayan ruins, as you talked about, it's been all over the TV. We know about the Mayans from watching Discovery and National Geographic. What do we know about the sort of the arc of Mayan cultural evolution? It rose. It peaked at one point, and then it was certainly disseminated and I wouldn't say dissolved over time. What do we know now about that culture?
Well, I'm not a Mayanist. I'll be humble here. And what we've tried to show in the exhibition are things that astonish the average person. They had these great city centers, and people don't really know what happened, most of them were abandoned in the 9th century. And new city centers began. Their civilization, obviously, was their civilizations, because as Emilio indicated, these are different groups. There is a pan-Maya movement today, but and when we say 30-plus languages, it's important to understand that they are so different from each other. It's as different as German from Norwegian, as French from Italian. They are very, very different, yet they're in this small area. I mean, Guatemala is slightly smaller than the state of Tennessee, and yet it's got 24. This civilization was really changed, obviously, when the Spanish invaded. There was that collapse of the 9th century. There were different movements of people and different groups that rose. But obviously, with the invasion in the 16th century, this is what changed everything. And you had a Spanish encomienda system where these people were forced to give tributes, particularly in certain areas of Guatemala and Yucatan. They didn't find gold and silver in those areas. And so that was disappointing to many of the Spanish conquerors, and they had to find a way to make those places profitable. And so essentially you had people paying to work on their own land. The situation really intensified. Their culture had to, in many ways, go underground. I mean, they continued to have priests and, to some degree, hieroglyphic writing, although suppressed, continued. The conquerors were interested, of course, in knowing their language because they wanted to convert them. And so then certain number of them were taught how to write their languages with a Latin alphabet. And you can imagine what a radical change that is. And then in the 19th century, things happen which are truly amazing to me, some of those episodes which we document in the exhibition, which people in the United States know nothing about, yet the United States was somewhat involved. The caste war of Yucatan, which was the longest running, one of the longest running insurgencies of the 19th century, from 1847 till 1901 when it was officially declared over.
And what was behind this war? What was happening?
Once the Spanish left, Yucatan, which was always, it's a peninsula, so it was always out of the orbit. They didn't really wish to be a part of Mexico. And they thought maybe it would be advantageous for them to be separate. And so there was a lot of movement for independence, and they were independent for a period. At that time also, they created big plantations and the Enniken plant from which rope was made. They started these big plantations, and they gobbled up a lot of land that the Maya were using for their own subsistence farming. A lot of the Maya actually fought in armies for independence, but the promises, such as relief from taxation, weren't fulfilled, and there were big uprisings. By 1850, the worst of it was over, but basically the population of Yucatan had been halved over 250,000 people had either fled or were killed.
Emilio, how much of the literature of dissent of the post-colonial period exists? That, to me, would be interesting to find that underground literature and to find out what people were saying when they thought they could do it in code and maybe not know what the, let the Spanish know what they were thinking.
Oh, that's the thing. It's after the conquest, a new chapter began because it was just employing now the Latin alphabet to keep memory, indigenous memories alive. But there are several texts. During the colonial period, we have texts like the Popol Vuh, from Maya Quiche. Also, there is a play from the 17th century, the Rabinala Chi, also from the Quiche. The Kakchikel people also wrote chronicles. So they have a famous text called the Kakchikel Chronicles. The famous books of the Chilambalam, which include some predictions about the end of the world, and I think that's where a lot of people are getting these ideas about, the end of the long count calendar as the end of the world. So those were written during the colonial period, and also there are manuscripts that were written by some indigenous intellectuals that joined the Spanish in the conquest. These texts are called lienzos today, they chronicle things like how they decided to join the Spanish to conquer other peoples. A famous one is the lienzo of Cuaquecholan, and written by some Nahuatl speaking peoples that joined the Spanish in the conquest.
How many of those texts had to be kept secret? Were they all available and sort of known to the...
A text like the Popol Vuh is fascinating because it was written between 1554 and 1558, and it was discovered in the 1700s, in 1713, by a Spanish priest, Francisco Jimenez. And he was the one who transcribed the original text and then made it visible for the church, and it was later stolen, went to France, and then made a comeback. And so it's now located, it's now located at the Newberry Library in Chicago.
And the importance of the exhibit, would you say, Claudia, what is it?
You learn about another culture. It was a very powerful experience for me to actually work on it and select material because I was keenly aware of the fact that, as I said, it's an astonishing chapter in the history of the book. This is a culture only four pre-conquest Maya codices survive. Their books were systematically destroyed. Not only was their writing system suppressed, but these books were destroyed. The Maya people have not had their own voice, and here you are yet again, another person from the outside, trying to tell that story of their not having their own voice. I think you learn about other ways of thinking. I learned a lot of history I didn't know about. I didn't know much about the caste war of Yucatan, and it was a major event. The United States was considering intervening. The United States was even considering annexing Yucatan as a state. James Polk, our UNC graduate, was president at the time. You get the idea that you should listen to other cultures. The conclusion of the exhibit, really, Emilio selected a lot of recent literature that's been written by Maya. There's value in a pluralistic society.
Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you
very much.
Claudia Funke is the curator of rare books at the Wilson Library. Emilio de Valle Escalante is an associate professor of Spanish at UNC. The exhibit at Wilson Library called Ancient and Living Maya in the 19th and 20th Centuries, Archaeological Discovery, Literary Voice, and Political Struggle is showing through January 27th. God willing, we'll be there. So for more information, you go to lib.unc.edu/Wilson. Just ahead, the music of Greg Humphrey. Stay tuned.
Must be the moon. Must be the moon. Must be the moon. Shine.